Hello and welcome to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In this edition of the New York Times Magazine for July 26, 2026, a feature story. Why do some dementia patients, quote unquote, return just before they die? As they near death, some dementia patients recover mental faculties assumed to be long lost. Researchers want to know why. This article was written by Billy Brennan. In the spring of 2000, while completing his degree in psychology at the University of Vienna, Alexander Bathyany received an unusual call from his mother. She had just gotten off the phone with Bathyany's grandmother. "I do not know what happened, but you should call," his mother told him. "Somehow she's back again." Bathyany was confused. His grandmother, who lived in a nursing home in Switzerland, had vascular dementia and, for the past year, had hardly been able to speak, let alone pick up the phone and initiate a conversation, as his mother claimed had just occurred. Naum called it terminal lucidity. In his research, he had come across many remarkable instances, including the story of a 26-year-old woman, Anna Katharina Emmer, who died in a German psychiatric hospital in 1922. Emmer reportedly had never learned to speak, but according to the accounts of two witnesses, spent the final half hour of her life in bed singing hymns. Similar seemingly impossible behavior, Naum found, had been seen in people with dementia, tumors, neurological disorders, abscesses the size of a hen's egg, and many other forms of brain-ravaging illness. Bathyany realized immediately that Naum was describing what occurred with his grandmother, and that he must not be the only one with such an experience. As a psychologist, he grew interested in the ways the events might affect those who witnessed them. He worked with colleagues to send out surveys, seeking cases from the modern era. Soon he had collected more than 60 reports, most of them relating to people living with dementia. In story after story, Bathyany's respondents described elderly people who suddenly reached for a loved one's hand, made amends for past wrongs, offered thanks, or simply seemed, through a shift in their eyes, to become present again. In 2014, Batthyani's initial findings were presented at the annual conference of the International Association for Near-Death Studies. An article that came out after the conference caught the attention of Basil Eldada, a program officer at the National Institute on Aging, a division of the National Institutes of Health. Eldada had a long-standing personal interest in the science of human consciousness, stretching back to his days as a medical resident. He followed the neuroscientific literature and kept up with research into poorly understood phenomena like near-death experiences. For Eldada, terminal lucidity was particularly intriguing because it appeared in people with dementia, one of the populations he focused on in his work at the NIA's geriatrics branch. Reading Batthyani's case reports, Eldada thought about Alzheimer's disease and its relentless destruction of brain matter. The effects of that degeneration were said to be irreversible, and people with Alzheimer's were often spoken of as if they disappeared in lockstep with the progression of the disease. But if it were true that mental clarity and memory could return in the last stages of the disease, even just temporarily, Eldada realized, it would call into question our models of what is actually going on in the brain. Eldada secured funding for a two-day workshop where researchers could discuss what was known about the lucidity phenomenon and how best to study it. In June 2018, 9 experts in nursing, geriatrics, neuroscience, psychology, patient care, and linguistics assembled in a conference room at the NIA office in Bethesda, Maryland. There was an air of uncertainty and excitement. At Eldada's invitation, Batthyani flew in from Vienna to present his case collection. Eldada also invited George Mashour, an anesthesiologist and neuroscientist at the University of Michigan, to present on the science of consciousness. Mashour and several other attendees shared that, like Batthyani, they had witnessed lucid episodes firsthand. But the more the researchers discussed the phenomenon, the more it confounded them. Mashour likened the brain in late-stage Alzheimer's to a pothole-ridden highway system on the verge of collapse, the biological traffic of mind and memory no longer able to flow. If this were happening with actual highways, he told me, at no point would we say, well, you know what, just before this highway totally collapses, we're going to have a really smooth ride. We'd say, it's just going to get worse and worse until the whole damn thing crumbles. The challenge in trying to study the phenomenon was that the workshop attendees didn't know exactly what they were looking for. Because so little research existed, the lucid episodes' distinguishing characteristics, based solely on anecdote, were poorly defined. Batthyani's case reports indicated that many lucid episodes lasted just minutes and could be easy to miss. To document them, the group concluded that scientists would probably need to set up cameras, and the cameras would need to run more or less continuously. They thought it best not to limit the search to the days before death. Some proposed they think of the phenomena as paradoxical lucidity, which would not only lessen the emphasis on death, but also better reflect one of the main questions of interest. How could the mind resurface in a brain so terribly damaged by disease? Leaving the workshop, the attendees saw in the phenomena the potential not just for improved caregiving practices, but perhaps even a new understanding of the nature of dementia. And for some of them, the potential went even further. As Eldada told me, paradoxical lucidity seemed to offer an opportunity to scientifically investigate the most fundamental question that we as humans have to grapple with, the relationship between the body and the mind, and the nature of consciousness itself. In 2018, When Eldada convened the workshop, the Alzheimer's field was going through a shift, as decades of research into treatments had come up frustratingly short. The atmosphere and a recent funding increase at the NIH meant there was more willingness, as Eldada put it, to take a risk. The year after the workshop, the NIA began a $10 million initiative to study lucidity in people with late-stage dementia. When Andrea Gilmore-Bikofsky, an associate professor in emergency medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, saw that the NIA was interested in video research on lucid episodes, she knew one way to approach the problem. Her past work had involved filming people with dementia during interactions with nursing staff, and then meticulously analyzing the videos, second by second, to assess which types of care affected patients' behavioral symptoms. She proposed retooling those video methods to study lucidity. Gilmore-Bikofsky knew that people with dementia showed modest fluctuations in cognition frequently enough, particularly at the mild and moderate stages. She had also seen firsthand how, in the right environment and the presence of good caregivers, the behavioral symptoms of dementia could sometimes lessen. But the turnarounds described by the NIA were said to be more pronounced and especially likely to occur in the final days or hours of life, a deeply sensitive time for cameras to be rolling at a patient's bedside. Knowing she would need to closely partner with a medical facility and its staff to have any chance of success, Gilmore-Bikofsky reached out to a hospice nearby, A Grace, which had a 12-bed memory care unit. The hospice agreed to work with her team, and in 2020, the NIA awarded her a grant. Lucid episodes were thought to be quite rare. Gilmore-Bikofsky suspected her odds of documenting the phenomena in such a small study were low. The cameras were set up in December 2021, and to the UW team's surprise, the first episodes occurred not long after. By then, Allison Colson, a nurse who served as the team's data collector, had worked with Joan Stephen, an 89-year-old resident, for a few months and not gotten a lot of back and forth, she told me. Stephen had largely stopped speaking and had appeared not to recognize her family members for several months. Suddenly, while looking at old photos of her children one day, she named them. Cameras were running not long after when she recalled her late husband, John, and shared, in full sentences, specific details about his job. He worked for Comstock Tire. She also recognized a picture of the award-winning rose bushes she tended for decades before Alzheimer's took away her focus and made them wither. When Colson showed the videos to Stephen's daughter, she said she was amazed. "It was extremely exciting," Colson told me. The UW team protects the anonymity of its study participants. Some of the subjects' family members permitted the team to share details with the Times. Sometime later, another participant, an elderly man with Alzheimer's, whose verbal output the researchers assessed to be minimally coherent, showed an even starker change. The man had been mobile throughout the full 10 years of his illness, but over a two-week period, his energy notably declined and he began spending more time sleeping in bed. Seeing this, nurses made the decision to tell his family to gather. The end seemed to be near. By the time his family members arrived, however, the man had gotten out of bed and begun speaking. During his decline, he had reverted, as many bilingual patients with Alzheimer's do, to his native language. Now he spoke clearly in English again, reminiscing about his childhood and his father. The nurses and his family were stunned. He stayed alert like this for 2 days, at one point telling his family, "I'm leaving soon." 9 days after the episode ended, he died. Along with the UW team, the NIA sent funding to 5 other research groups. One of those teams, based at the Mayo Clinic, focused its efforts on surveying caregivers about their experiences with lucid episodes. As the data came back, they found that there appeared to be different types. Some episodes resembled the prototypical cases of terminal lucidity, like those that Nam and Batiani reported, with heightened recoveries occurring close to death. But many more were subtle instances, a flash in the eyes, a few meaningful words that occurred weeks or even months before death. Many caregivers were deeply moved, but the events were not always positive on balance. Sometimes they were totally negative, Joan Griffin, the lead researcher on the Mayo Clinic team, told me. We had one caregiver who was like, "My dad was an expletive when I was young and he had a lucid episode, and he was an expletive when he came back. He was a terrible father and it reminded me about why he was so bad." The Mayo Clinic group found that some events seemed to be triggered by the environment, for instance, by familiar music or old friends who reminisced in the person's presence. The triggers did not appear to be reliable or replicable, but many caregivers made elaborate attempts to elicit the episodes again. Griffin recalled a woman in her study who said her husband had not spoken for years. One night, as they ate his favorite dinner, eggplant parmesan, he looked at her and said her name. Thinking the meal had triggered the moment, the woman made the dinner again the following week and served it to him, hoping he would come back. He never did. Andrew Peterson, an investigator on a research team at the University of Pennsylvania, told me about a report of a man with advanced dementia who, seeing his son approach the top of a staircase, suddenly said, "Be careful." The son repeatedly returned to the stairs and pretended he was about to fall, hoping to hear his father's voice again. By the time the UW team approached Ed Janis about joining the study in 2023, his partner, Mary Mobius, had lost most of her ability to speak. For 33 years, Mary had taught middle school language arts in Verona, Wisconsin, not far from Madison. She had been sharp-witted and a little shy, but in 2014, Ed noticed her personality starting to change. She grew paranoid and combative. She began to get lost. The woman, who once spent hours spilling out her thoughts to him in all their complexity, struggled to find her words. She was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and as the disease progressed, their conversations became fewer, her sentences more and more confused. Now 74 and in hospice at A Grace, Mary tended to get stuck in repetitive rhyming loops of sounds when she spoke. Ed chose to believe that Mary had learned a coherent, lost language that he simply couldn't understand. He called it Ancient Sumerian. Then, on October 13, 2023, with the camera focused on her, Mary spoke clearly again. In a small common area, a nurse's assistant prepared a lunch of beans and casserole for her. Mary, dressed in a red shirt, sat in a specialized ergonomic wheelchair. Her thick gray hair shot out in all directions. A rerun of The Price is Right played on a nearby TV. Suddenly, Mary's eyes appeared to light up. She reached toward the nurse's assistant with an index finger extended. The assistant pulled away and laughed to someone nearby. "She tried to shove her finger up my nose." Mary dropped her face into one hand. Quietly, she said, "I'm getting ready to go." "You're getting ready to go?" the assistant said. That was a full sentence. "Where are you going?" "I don't know," Mary said. "That's why I'm looking to you." "You're looking to me? I don't have directions." The assistant offered her a spoonful of food, but Mary took her by the hand and stopped her. "Not yet." Mary looked around the room. The assistant, seemingly preoccupied with making sure Mary ate, held out a carton of chocolate milk with a straw, but Mary didn't take it. Instead, she took the assistant's hand, made eye contact, and said somewhat haltingly, "I can't kill myself here." The assistant seemed caught off guard and stumbled for a second. "No, we don't want to do that," she said. Mary's gaze dropped. She leaned forward and covered her eyes with her hand. "Do you have a headache?" the assistant asked. Mary looked up. "Yes, I do." Hearing Mary's reply from across the room, Robin Shearer, the nurse on shift at the time, responded in surprise. "Okay, that was pretty clear." Some time passed. Shearer came with a cup of painkiller-infused ice cream. When Mary tasted the dessert, she said, "That's what I wanted." Shearer joked with Mary, giving her a second helping of ice cream and doing a celebratory dance. "We did it!" Mary laughed. "You did it," she said. She kept talking to Shearer, but her speech was now dipping in and out of intelligible words. The flash of lucidity seemed to be ending. Shearer and the nurse's assistant went back to work and didn't mention what happened. But several weeks later, a graduate student who was screening the tapes flagged the moment. Coulson gathered the two in a kitchenette to review the video. As part of the study protocol, she needed to make sure that people familiar with Mary thought something atypical had occurred. The answer was clear. Seeing themselves going about their work as Mary tried, quietly but consistently, to communicate with them was jarring. The nurse's assistant broke out in tears. As soon as the video ended, she went to find Mary in the unit's activity room. She hugged Mary, Shearer told me, and said, "I am so sorry that you have been trying to talk to me and I have not been listening to you, and I'm sorry that you could not find the language to tell me that you were in pain. And I promise you I will never ignore these signs again, not for you and not for anyone else." When Ed saw the video, he felt conflicted. He said he was happy to hear Mary's voice again. He noted the apparent increase in her awareness, the disappearance of the ancient Sumerian, but he found her tone inscrutable and struggled to understand what she could have meant. When she said, "I can't kill myself here," was she asking the nurse for reassurance that she was safe? Was she trying to say something about the way she'd been treated? Did she feel trapped, depressed, afraid? "It may well be that Mary's soul is back," he told Coulson. In a 2011 paper in the Archives of Gerontology and Geriatrics, Michael Naum, the parapsychologist who first identified terminal lucidity, and the University of Virginia psychiatrist Bruce Grison, noted what they saw as a deeper mystery revealed by episodes of lucidity and dementia. The phenomenon seemed to show that the mind could continue to function even when the brain was significantly impaired. This was hard to reconcile, they observed, with the mainstream scientific belief in reductive materialism, which holds that consciousness originates from biophysical processes in the brain. If you believe that everything we see and hear and feel and think and decide comes solely from the brain, Grison told me recently, then you have to propose a mechanism for how the brain does that when it's been deteriorating for years and years and not been able to do those things. How does it suddenly recover those abilities? It was because of this that Naum and Grison thought lucid episodes could teach scientists about the mind-body relationship and the nature of consciousness itself. When the NIA announced the funding for research into paradoxical lucidity in 2019, the potential to explore these questions also caught the interest of Sam Parnia, a brain and consciousness researcher at New York University, who now leads one of the NIA studies. Parnia is best known for conducting the largest and most rigorous studies to date of near-death experiences in survivors of cardiac arrest. He prefers to call these recalled experiences of death and considers near-death experience vague and unscientific. It was these studies that laid the foundation for his thinking about consciousness in those with late-stage dementia. In a series of conversations over the last 5 years, he explained how he saw unexpected episodes of lucidity as part of a growing evidence base that seriously challenges the materialistic paradigm. Studies have shown that up to 20% of people who survive a cardiac arrest report clear memories from the time when they were clinically dead. In his research, Parnia found that survivors' memories followed a distinct narrative arc. They felt themselves separate from their bodies, sometimes hovering above the scene and watching with a sense of detachment as doctors tried to revive them. They began traveling to a destination through what many perceived as a tunnel of light. They accessed a vast store of memory and underwent a review of every moment in their lives from multiple points of view simultaneously, judging the way their actions and intentions had affected others. And finally, although many protested, they re-entered their bodies, often utterly changed. The transformative nature of the experience could be seen in survivors' reduced fear of death, a newfound desire to seek deeper meaning in life, and, some other researchers have found, sky-high divorce rates. In a pair of studies known as AWARE 1 and AWARE 2, conducted from 2008 to 2020, Parnia tried to figure out if these subjective reports could be verified. To do so, he placed images above the patients' heads in rooms throughout various hospitals. His thinking was that a person who had a near-death experience while undergoing CPR might be able to report seeing the images and thus provide proof that the mind could truly separate from the body. In AWARE 2, an EEG machine was used to monitor for signs of brain activity in patients during CPR. The EEG readings showed that during the time when they were clinically dead, meaning their hearts had completely stopped, some patients' brains had periods of electrical activity consistent with conscious experience. But for some hopeful watchers, the AWARE studies ended in anticlimax. While one survivor in AWARE 1 recalled details of the procedures he'd seen himself undergo that were later verified, he had been resuscitated in a room where Parnia's images weren't installed. In AWARE 2, Parnia added a sound component. Bluetooth headphones placed over patients' ears doing CPR cycled through the names of three fruits: apple, pear, banana. Survivors were asked to list three random fruits that came to mind when they thought of their resuscitation. One named the correct three, but the sample size was too small to be sure it wasn't by chance. Even some scientists who believed Parnia's studies were a fool's errand praised the ambition and thoroughness of his approach. But the results were ambiguous enough that anyone involved in the debate over the nature of consciousness, materialistic or not, could find evidence to support the beliefs they already held. In his 2009 paper coining the phrase terminal lucidity, Nam cited Parnia's work on near-death experiences, noting what he saw as a commonality between the two phenomena, their relation to death. As his NIA study on paradoxical lucidity progressed, Parnia also came to feel that in certain cases, the experience of dying couldn't be ignored. In some episodes, Parnia said that people reconnected with their old sense of self, but they also looked forward, their words relating to a preparation for their departure. He told me, "They're expressing something lucid, but it isn't to do with their ordinary lives. It's something to do with what seems to be ahead of them." They often spoke about feelings of contentment, the presence of deceased loved ones, and a sense that they would soon be heading to a new destination, all features resonant with near-death experiences. Generally, Parnia said, the frequency of these terminal lucidity experiences seems to go up more in proximity to death. The NIA program has not investigated the brain mechanisms that enable episodes of lucidity in late-stage dementia, but Parnia thought the parallels he saw between lucid episodes and near-death experiences suggested a shared mechanism, what neuroscientists call disinhibition. In normal life, our brains are constantly blocking some neural pathways while keeping others open. This balance helps us focus on what matters to us most, eating, relationships, work, and prevents us from being flooded by all the information we're taking in at any given moment. Our general perceptions are that when your brain is disordered, you lose all function, Parnia told me. What we're finding is that, paradoxically, in disordered states, sometimes that disorder actually opens up pathways to new abilities that were hidden before. These instances of disinhibition seem to connect people, in Parnia's view, to parts of their consciousness that they couldn't access before. Parnia has a level of institutional prominence rarely seen in the world of near-death research. This authority made followers of the AWARE studies especially curious to know what he thought of his findings. Did he feel he had evidence that the mind could exist apart from the brain? That there was life after death? He responded cautiously while the studies were ongoing. But in his 2024 book, Lucid Dying, Parnia firmly staked his position in the mind-body debate. We are at the cusp of the exploration of a new frontier in science, he wrote, declaring himself quite optimistic that the nature of human consciousness, our very selfhood, will be discovered to be a flux of energy like the electromagnetic waves that interacts with the brain and body, but is not produced by them. Basil Eldada, who left his role at the NIA last April to become the director of a natural burial ground in Maryland, told me that the first AWARE study had partly inspired his approach to the lucidity research program. When I asked him what he thought paradoxical lucidity indicated about the mind-body relationship, he said that he felt the phenomenon did not offer the same kind of clear-cut challenge to the materialistic paradigm as near-death experiences did. I think you could easily propose that there is some residual capacity of the brain that somehow is able to be unleashed during lucid episodes in dementia, he told me. You don't have to invoke an alternative to materialism to explain all of lucidity, at least for now. We just don't understand enough about what's going on. Parnia told me his belief that consciousness most likely is not produced by the brain does not mean consciousness is magic, and it doesn't mean it's not scientific. The challenge, he said, is that scientists do not have ways to directly measure consciousness, whatever it is, and so investigating its nature has usually been left to philosophers. Parnia thinks that scientists should not shy away from pursuing those questions themselves, building off whatever evidence is available, and following the answers wherever they lead. The reasons why I'm more open to this is because when you look at people who die and come back, definitely their brain shuts down, he told me, and definitely at best, it is highly dysfunctional. At worst, it is non-functional. Yet we have 5 decades worth of data that tells us there is lucidity. There is paradoxical lucidity in death. I would now like to take a brief moment to remind you that you are listening to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The UW team published its findings last August in The Gerontologist, one of the top journals in the field. In evaluating the phenomenon, the study didn't just rely on how the nurses and caregivers responded. The video recordings offered the UW team something no one had ever seen before. The first objective data on the way people experiencing episodes of lucidity communicate. In each of the three people who had lucid episodes captured by the study, the team found significant shifts in communication and behavior. Some of the findings seemed obvious to anyone who watched the videos. Overall, each person spoke with a higher rate of meaningful vocalizations during a lucid episode, but the shifts went beyond words. In Mary's case, the study showed that in the moments when she appeared to be lucid, she held more eye contact and laughed more. Even the tiniest moments offered a wealth of insight. Both Mary and Joan Stephen, for instance, showed a higher propensity for using filler words like and which tell the listener that the speaker is aware of them and asking them to wait while they find the word they need. And when the nurse's assistant asked Mary if she had a headache, Mary's seemingly simple reply, "Yes, I do," suggested that her working memory, which temporarily holds and processes information and is often one of the first forms of memory to become impaired by Alzheimer's, was back. In some of the other NIA studies, similarly surprising levels of cognitive and functional recovery have been reported. Griffin, the head of the Mayo Clinic team, told me about a family in her study who spent their Christmas dinner debating where one of the children should go to college, an expensive private university in another part of the country, or a more affordable state school that was close to home. There was a lull in the conversation, and the grandfather, who had not spoken in something like 6 months, said, "I think he should probably go to the state school. It's more valuable, and it seems like it would be a better fit for him." Everyone around the table dropped their forks. The episode showed the family that not only could the grandfather speak, he had been processing the conversation the whole time. Gilmore Bukowski emphasized that the UW team study was just a small, early piece of the immense body of research that will be needed to understand episodes of lucidity. "People could spend their entire careers studying this," she told me. Recently, she and Griffin introduced a cross-disciplinary effort they call the Lucidity in Alzheimer's and Dementia Network, bringing together Parnia and about a dozen other researchers to systematically approach the phenomenon. They hope that these studies will one day help scientists explain what it is, why it occurs, and how to help those who witness or experience it. When I first began research for this article, many of the available written accounts of lucid episodes seem like chapters from a book of lost fables. Like Sleeping Beauty, Anna Katharina Emmer is robbed of her voice and her mind and spends her life unresponsive in bed, only to sing hymns at the hour of death. The videos I saw were remarkable but decidedly less literary. People's words weren't always clear. They answered one question, then fell silent to any follow-ups. They remembered the names of three of their children and, shown a photo, didn't name the fourth. There were no hymns or spontaneous poems here, but the words still reached people with an impact that reverberated in unpredictable directions. On a brisk morning in January, I met Colson, the UW nurse in charge of data collection at A Grace. Colson is friendly and inquisitive. She has kept in touch with some of the caregivers from the study. Despite having worked most of her nursing career in hospices, she told me she hadn't seen paradoxical lucidity until she began working with the UW team. The study had enrolled its 33rd participant not long before, and Colson was there to collect data. The memory care unit was a locked world unto itself, with carefully selected art meant to evoke familiar scenery from the residents' lives. Sun-drenched bales of hay, a wooden dock on a lake in the Wisconsin Dells, the dome of the state capitol towering over modest homes on the Madison Isthmus. Coulson greeted the participants as she went around the unit. She looked each person in the eyes and asked if it was okay for her to film. Not detecting any signs of dissent, she set the cameras up. One man lay in bed, opening his eyes every few moments to stare at the verdant blur of pine trees just beyond his window. Coulson tiptoed in and attached a microphone to his headboard where it could pick up anything he might say. Later that afternoon, Ed Janis, who had agreed to watch the tapes of Mary's lucid episodes with me, came by in a buoyant mood, but I detected a hint of reservation in his voice. "I hope you're not going to make me watch that awful video," he said, only half joking. Altogether, the study found that Mary briefly became lucid on 4 separate days. The video Ed had in mind was the only episode he had been present for. He opened his laptop and pressed play. In the video, Mary sits in a wheelchair in a hallway of the hospice. Ed enters the frame and puts a knit blanket over her shoulders. "Snug as a bug in a rug," he says to her. He steps off camera and starts talking to Coulson. "Looks like something from that movie where they're in the pods," Ed jokes. "Cocoon?" Coulson asks. "No, I don't know what movie you're talking about." "Neither do I." The camera captures Mary as she trains her eyes on them. Coulson suggests Ed watch the 2016 movie Arrival, in which aliens descend and baffle the planet with indecipherable messages until an enterprising linguist decodes their language. "It's a little scary, but it's fascinating. Fascinating to think about interspecies communication." Ed laughs. "Sometimes I feel that way about Mary. Interspecies communication." At that moment, looking toward Ed, Mary lets out a rolling laugh. Then softly she says, "Come this way." Ed doesn't hear Mary, but Coulson does. She said, "Come this way." Surprised, Ed turns and faces Mary. He pats her shoulder. He gently brushes a hand over an errant tuft of her gray hair. Then he turns around and begins chatting with Coulson again. As we watch the video together in January, Ed's entire body tensed up. Seeing himself turn away from Mary and joke as if she weren't sitting right there left him feeling an ache of regret. Loss in dementia is often conceived of as the destruction of the 6-person self, but what Ed felt was the pain of a shared loss, the loss of his ability to connect his mind to Mary's. When he watched the videos, I saw him struggling to understand Mary's tiniest gestures and words, unable to settle on a convincing interpretation. Even the moments of lucid speech brought only more questions. Mary was undeniably acting in those moments in ways she hadn't for many years, but if lucidity implies clarity, Ed's experience of the episodes was anything but clear. A couple of months after Mary arrived at a Grace in 2023, Ed could see that she was slipping into the final depths of her illness. On January 25th, 2024, around 4 a.m., a nurse called Ed to tell him Mary was dying. Ed and a friend of Mary's, Marilyn Rhodes, gathered at a Grace. Rhodes sat at Mary's bedside listening to her breaths. "At the moment Mary breathed out for the last time," Rhodes recalled, "everyone in the room looked out the window to see this bright red bird in this misty green backdrop. Mary's favorite, a cardinal." It was one of those experiences where it doesn't matter what the explanation is, Ed said. It's not the point. Ed scheduled a memorial service for Mary in a park that July. As the day approached, he tried to write a eulogy, but his words fell flat. He wrote a dozen drafts and discarded them all. One day he realized that rather than listening to him talk about Mary, maybe people would want to hear Mary speak. because Mary could be quite talkative and she, for sure, still had a lot to say. As he sat at his computer, an image came to him. A cardinal carrying a letter in its claws. The letter was from Mary. He imagined opening it. He began to type the words he saw. "I suspended disbelief," he told me. "I let Mary write." Billy Brennan, who wrote this article, is a freelance journalist. He last wrote for the magazine about the orthodontists, John and Mike Mew. And now I'd like to share with you just a few of the comments written in by readers of this article. From Susan in Pennsylvania, "As a pastor who often is at bedside with actively dying people, I have seen this phenomenon on more than one occasion. Just a few weeks ago, I was with a parishioner who had been nearly comatose for days, who suddenly sat up and said he was hungry and wanted a hot dog, which he gobbled down and then asked for pizza. He was only lucid for an hour or so, then died the next day. I have found that hospice workers in particular are quite familiar with the period of lucidity that often precedes death. Thank you for this article." And from Histuck in Tampa, "As a geriatrician and hospice doctor, I would see what I think of as a related phenomena. I would be seeing a patient with dementia in my clinic, brought in by family who related that the patient, usually a woman, had been a full-time caregiver for her husband just a few months before my visit. It was so hard to believe that this patient with advanced dementia had been able to manage her husband's care and had declined so rapidly after his death. The focus and overwhelming purpose of her life as a caregiver had been so powerful as to keep the manifestations of dementia at bay. I did not think it was depression or grief that caused the decline. It seemed that it was the profound loss of meaning that occurred with the death. The analogy of a highway offered by one of the doctors in the article, riddled with potholes that suddenly becomes drivable, may not be the best one. Maybe there are multiple side roads that exist, often unused, gravel paths really that open up and that allow for a very temporary drive forward around the potholes of the brain. Fascinating article. Thank you so much." From CG in New York, "This happened to my mother 1 month before her passing. The few minutes she returned to lucidity was like a miracle and gave her the opportunity to say goodbye as her true self. And then she disappeared forever. I'll remember and cherish that precious moment for the rest of my days." And finally, from Dave Muse in Berkeley, "One of my grandmothers lived to be 105. She said the week before she died that suddenly childhood memories were coming back to her. She suddenly started singing French nursery songs that her French mother had sang to her and her sisters that she had not heard for over 102 years, as her mother had died when she was 3 years old in Iowa." Actually, there's one more I'd like to share with you. This is from Carol Hill in Bordentown. "I have a friend whose mother had dementia. She did not know her daughter. On her deathbed, my friend was sitting and watching her mother. Her mother opened her eyes and said, 'Hi, Vicky, I love you.' Vicky told her mother she loved her too. Her mother died. True story." And now, with the few minutes we have remaining, this article, "Why Does This Jacket Cost $770? Because it made me a new man. Lots of men are geeking out over very expensive clothes, and I became one of them." This article was written by Sam Anderson. "I am not a fashionable man. I spend my life walking around in an exoskeleton made of baseball hats and old flannels. Occasionally, deep inside my dumpy cocoon, I hear muffled rumors about other ways to live. That there is, for instance, a whole elaborate universe revolving around what aficionados call menswear, different from the broad clothing category of men's wear. Guys who spend their lives and paychecks obsessing like Talmudic scholars over exotic fabrics, buttons, shirts, hats. For me, learning about this raised a few obvious questions. For instance, why? And what on earth? And also, huh? What could possibly explain this growing contingent of men who spend hours online discussing artisanal, small batch, outrageously expensive clothing? Can anyone participate? If I were to slip into a pair of $600 shorts, would it instantly change my life? How much men would a menswear wear if a menswear could wear men? I called Jonah Weiner, a fellow writer for this magazine and co-founder of the popular style newsletter Blackbird Spy Plane. Jonah talks about fashion like Chef Boyardee talks about Mamma Mia cans of noodles. He told me about all kinds of wizardry, a Japanese brand that makes natural fibers seem like synthetic fibers, another Japanese brand that recreates arcane military footwear in lavish detail. When I asked Jonah what he was wearing right now, his answer did not disappoint. A platonic ideal of heavyweight cotton black drawstring sweatpants, he said, along with a sweater knit out of cotton and mohair. Although he acknowledged that this might seem over the top for a regular Tuesday morning, the word mohair in particular tends to get eyes rolling, Jonah said something that I would later see frequently in menswear discussions. Truly special clothing is not just about luxury for the sake of luxury. It is, like all great art, a way to get us to pay attention. In our disembodied world of avatars and glass screens and disposable mass-produced clothing, a beautiful garment can allow us to remember our bodies, to think about how we sit in the world, to take real pleasure in dalliness. Jonah urged me to go see some menswear for myself, to feel the fabrics, try things on, see what happens. So I went down to CHCM, a Manhattan shop that is legendary on the menswear forums. I actually walked past it twice before I noticed the entrance, a nondescript door down a narrow set of stairs. Inside it was small and plain, stark white floor, techno music. It felt like an art gallery. Everything was obviously expensive and rare and important, if I couldn't say exactly why. I walked around pinching fabric, scrutinizing colors, gawking at price tags. Some pieces were so outlandish I couldn't imagine putting them onto a human body as boring as mine. After a few minutes, however, something changed. Menswear and I started to creep toward each other. Riffling through a rack, I saw a flannel, my native sartorial language, but the material was unlike any of my flannels at home. It was thick and generous and meaty, like an Italian grandmother's handmade ravioli. I could absolutely wear that, I thought. Then I saw a light, billowy windbreaker covered with bright flowers, something I would never put on. But what if I should? What if I am actually a different human being than I ever suspected? For the next 90 minutes or so, I zoomed around the narrow store, back and forth trying things on, comparing incrementally different shirts and hats. One coat made me feel like a Russian novelist. Another made me feel like a secretly fascinating cabbie. I could feel myself becoming obsessive, frenzied. I was starting to covet things. What if one of these garments held the key to my soul, but I hesitated, and then some other guy came along and snatched it off the rack? Eventually, I zeroed in on an Australian brand called Mantle, which is spelled MANTLE. I have no idea what the hyphen in the middle is up to. Menswear brands love to sprinkle punctuation marks around willy-nilly. Their clothes were practical and no-nonsense, with subtle touches of strangeness, funky pockets, strips of seat belt fabric. Almost against my will, I tried on a baseball hat. I didn't need it. I own way too many hats already, but there was something about this one. It was plain blue, no logo, and it fit my head like an avocado fits its pit. It cost $160. Then I tried on a boat shirt, a light jacket apparently made of cotton, infused with paraffin wax. It had pocket openings shaped like giant Tic Tacs. It cost $770. Surprising even myself, I bought them both. Wearing these items out into the real world, grocery store, post office, train station, dentist, felt strange. They are inconspicuous luxury clothes with no famous logo or flashy colors, so I felt sneakily fancy, like a spy with a dangerous secret. But then people started making comments. "That hat makes you look rich," said my wife. "Nice jacket," said a hotel clerk. I wasn't sure I liked this. I felt exposed, like a hermit crab who'd exchanged his dirty old shell for a big, glittering, fancy conch, and suddenly all the lobsters were staring at me. I realized viscerally that I prefer it when no one is looking at my clothes, even or especially to give me compliments. What did I buy at the menswear shop? It wasn't just fabric. It wasn't just beautifully made clothes. It was the curse / blessing of heightened self-awareness. Wearing these clothes made me feel visible to others and to myself in a whole new way. That might feel exquisite to a certain type of guy, someone who isn't already waterlogged with self-consciousness to the point of sinking, or who experiences that feeling in a different way, as a kind of lifting. But that's not me. Although the clothes fit my body perfectly, if I want to truly become a menswear guy, I'll need some tailoring for my mind. Sam Anderson, who wrote this article, is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. Thank you so much for joining me for this edition of the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Please join me again for the New York Times Magazine program.